Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for July's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, European and RCVS specialist in small animal surgery orthopaedics, Heidi Rottke. Thank you, Heidi. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Much, Ima, for the introduction and a welcome to our audience. Excision arthroplasty, at least the one of the coxofemoral joint, is one of the most frequently performed surgeries, very frequently performed in first opinion practice, and probably not only for me, but also for other surgeons, it will be one of the first orthopedic surgeries they do. However, it does not come without pitfalls. And this is the background of today's webinar. At the end of this webinar, you should be able to define the term joint salvage procedure, describe the related biomechanical changes and associated possible complications, discuss the decision-making process in choosing this treatment method, recall the critical surgical steps, propose a rehabilitation plan for dogs and cats after excision arthroplasty, and devise a plan how to address possible complications associated with this surgery. We will look at the indications, biomechanical effects, the reported outcomes, including complications, in detail into the surgical technique and into a rehabilitation protocol. We will mainly concentrate on the coxofemoral joint. As I said, this is the most common joint where this type of surgery is performed, but I will also speak about excision arthroplasty of the shoulder joint and phalangeal joints at the end. So the excision arthroplasty is a so-called joint salvage procedure. Let's take a couple of minutes to think about definition of that term. The Merriam-Webster dictionary gives us this explanation. Salvage is the act of saving something, such as a building, a ship, or cargo, that is in danger of being completely destroyed, or to remove something from a place so that it will not be damaged, destroyed, or lost. So if we use this definition for our joint salvage procedure, we could define it as a situation where the joint as such cannot be preserved, but we aim to preserve the movement and function of the limb instead. Usually, this is a last resort option that is incorporated in the term salvage, and it cannot be reversed, usually. So let's look at the coxofemoral joint in more detail. Here the excision arthroplasty is called a femoral head and neck excision, FHNE, or sometimes more frequently used, particularly in the American room area, a femoral head and neck osteotomy, an FHO. The principle of an FHNE or FHO is to excise the femoral head and neck, and by doing that, eliminating bone contact between the pelvis and femur in order to palliate pain. Removal of the femoral head and neck will result in a so-called pseudoarthrosis. And this means that dense fibrous tissue will be laid down, lined by a synovial membrane. In order for the limb to still function, the surrounding musculature is absolutely crucial. And this is something we always need to remember when performing or when thinking about performing an excision arthroplasty. Inadvertently, there will be overall effects of a femoral head and neck excision due to the changed anatomy and the changed forces. The proximal musculature, the gluteal muscles with the gluteal, superficial gluteal marked with a red dot, middle gluteal marked with a green dot, and the deep gluteal muscle marked with a yellow dot, they will apply a proximally acting force. And because we don't have a connection between acetabulum and femoral head, the leg will become shorter. The animal will try to make up for that shortened leg by holding the stifle more extended and the overall limb being more externally rotated. So what do you think the main and expected effects of an FHO or FHNE will be on the overall limb function? We should expect a decreased range of motion and some degree of muscle atrophy. And there might even be a gait abnormality, which ideally is not associated with pain. And that's what we would call a mechanical lameness. Let's look at indications for a femoral head and neck excision. Femoral head and neck fractures, which are non-repairable, would be on that list. Possibly also feline spontaneous capital physeal fractures, catastrophic acetabular fractures, non-reducible or failed coxofemoral luxations, failed total hip replacements, chronic pain associated with hip degenerative joint disease, which could be traumatically induced, which could be related with canine avascular femoral head and neck necrosis, or with feline metaphyseal osteopathy, or very frequently, of course, canine hip dysplasia, and to a lesser degree, at least clinically relevant feline hip dysplasia. We will review this list critically once again at the end of this section. Several complications have been reported after femoral head and neck excision, and in these following slides we want to look at what do we know about the outcomes. Complications reported are ongoing lameness associated not only with limb shortening but also with pain, so more than a mechanical lameness. Patellar luxation, limitation in range of hip motion accompanied by severe muscle atrophy, and sciatic neuropraxia. Sciatic neuropraxia has, for example, been reported by Nick Jeffrey in VCOT 1993, where two dogs had ischiatic nerve entrapment after a femoral head and neck excision. And this was related with incorporating a muscle flap to reduce bone-on-bone contact after the osteotomy. This is a technique which had been advised for some time, but in our days, the interposition of muscle flaps following FHNE is no longer recommended. There is a general perception that function after FHNE is better in small dogs and cats compared with larger dogs. And this is based upon a widely accepted presumption that the ability to compensate for the mechanical disadvantages of an absent coxofemoral joint depends on body weight, with lighter animals having an advantage. However, functional disabilities have also been reported in many small breed dogs and cats subjected to femoral head and neck excision. There is one paper which gives us the most information and looked at the largest number of animals, and that's by Off and Mattis, published in VCOT 2010. And they had 183 animals, 132 dogs, and 51 cats. And they assessed the outcome 4 years after surgery following FHNE based on follow-up veterinary examination, and they did clinical radiographic and gait analysis, follow-up examinations, and that was supplemented by an owner assessment. They found that 38% of the dogs had a good outcome, 20% were graded as satisfactory, and 42% of these animals were graded as having a poor outcome. They also give us a little bit more information on anatomic findings. 84% had a dorsal displacement of the femur. As discussed, this is already something we would expect to some degree. 75% had muscle atrophy, 74% a restricted range of motion, and 32% experience pain during passive movement. In 2003, in JAFMA, Griesenau et al. Reported on the effects of post-operative administration of ketoprofen and carprofen on short and long-term results of femur head and neck excision. Their hypothesis was that giving pain medication would positively influence the overall outcome, and they could not prove that hypothesis. They had 40 client-owned large breed dogs and 15 healthy large breed dogs as control. They did find that animals with an FHNE had a significantly lower peak vertical, peak propulsive, and impulsive propulsive forces compared to the normal limbs. They also found that the treatment of an acute condition and preservation of the lesser trochanter in surgery were positively associated with the ground reaction forces on day 120. They also had some information, 12 in regards to the pain medication. 12 of 31 dog owners indicated that the dog's gait worsened for a few days after discontinuation of analgesic administration. So one could conclude that pain medication has a positive effect in the rehabilitation, but not in the overall outcome according to this study. So what cases could be trauma cases in which a femur head and neck excision is to be considered? And I brought you here an example of a cat with severe pelvic fractures. If we look at that radiograph here a little bit closer, the left of the animal is to your right side, so we have a left sacroiliac luxation with cranial displacement, severe pelvic floor fractures, which is obvious also on the lateral view when we see here the drop down pelvic floor, and then we have highly comminuted fractures of the left of the right, sorry, the right ilial wing, ilial body, and the acetabulum. So in a case like this, acetabular reconstruction is not possible. And a total hip replacement is also not an option at this moment because we don't have bone stock in the acetabular area. So therefore, in this case, a femur head and neck excision was performed in addition to surgical fixation of the ilium and acetabulum, and this is with the aim to restore the pelvic canal. The next case is a canine example, a dog, mixed breed, medium-sized dog with again severe pelvic fractures. We have on the right side an ilial body fracture with a low grade of comminution. On the left side, We have a very comminuted acetabular and ileal fracture with a triangular fragment of the ileum and acetabulum here cranially, see here on the lateral view, and severe displacement, medial subluxation of the femoral head. So in this case, again, preservation of the acetabulum is not possible, and therefore a femoral head and neck excision was performed in addition to surgical stabilization of the ileum on both sides, resulting in a weight-bearing axis on the right side and alignment of the pelvic canal overall. Here's another example, a dog with an acetabular fracture. Overall, these injuries look more local compared to our other two cases, an acetabular fracture with some displacement and some subluxation of the femoral head, some degree of fragmentation of the medial wall of the acetabulum. This dog was taken to surgery and acetabular repair was attempted and resulted in this really pretty looking lateral post-operative view. Approach was made via a trochanter osteotomy and fixation with a tension band and then application of this acetabular plate. However, directly on the post-operative view, there is severe subluxation of the femoral head visible. And this is related with the fracture of the medial wall of the acetabulum. So in a case like this, then a femoral head and neck excision can be considered. Again, total hip replacement at this moment is not an option because we don't have bone stock at this moment. So that could be considered as a possible stage procedure. In some cases, one could also attempt and consider medial wall fixation, as we can see here on the slide on the left. This is a different dog, but in this particular case, a femoral head and neck excision was performed. We do have some reported outcomes after femoral head and neck excision for cats, and that has been a quite recent paper in the Journal of Feline Medicine and Surgery 2015 by Yap et al. And they looked at the medium and long-term functional outcome in 18 cats after femoral head and neck excision. They had owner-completed questionnaires and a minimum of 4 months post-operatively. And these questionnaires assess the ability of the cats to perform normal feline activities, a change of demeanor or behavior, the necessity for long-term analgesia, and the time to take to resume normal activities. This questionnaire has been used successfully to assess other aspects of surgery, for example, pancarpal arthrodesis in cats. They found that 17 out of these 18 cats could perform normal feline activities without or with a slight difficulty at follow-up. One cat had a notable persistent difficulty in climbing. The majority of cats took between 1 and 2 months to resume normal activity. There was no change in demeanor or behavior noted in any of the cats. And none of the cats required long-term analgesia. The authors of this paper concluded, based on the owner-completed questionnaire, cats have a good to excellent medium to long-term functional outcome after adequately performed femoral head and neck excision. So there seems to be a difference compared to our results in dogs. The most common reason for a poor outcome in dogs and cats after femoral head and neck excision is bone-to-bone contact between the proximal femur and the acetabulum. And this may or may not be related to inadequate femoral neck resection. Therefore, our surgical technique is absolutely crucial. And that's what our next slides will look into in more detail. So we do a standard craniolateral approach to the hip joint with the aim to be really gentle to the supportive soft tissue structures. In order to do that, we need to recognize reliably the origin and insertions of the hip musculature, and we need to be able to perform a correct and precise osteectomy. We do routine anesthesia and clip for a hanging leg. There are two options. Either we do a hanging leg or we just drape over the leg and just have access to the hip joint. A hanging leg preparation has the advantage that we can manipulate the leg easily in our surgical field, and that can help with the osteectomy. For the craniolateral approach to the hip joint, our bony landmarks to palpate are cranial, the ilial wing, here with the red arrow, caudally, the ischial tubercle with the blue arrow, and the greater trochanter with the green arrow. The incision will be made just slightly cranial to the greater trochanter in a proximal to distal direction. Then we identify biceps femoris, the tensor fascia lata, and the gluteal musculature. We don't want to disrupt these structures until we really appreciate the muscular planes. And then we want to incise the plane between the tensor fascia lata and the biceps femoris and separate them and retract the tensor fascia lata cranially and the biceps caudally. At the very caudal aspect of our greater trochanter runs the sciatic nerve. So that is also important to keep in mind for our further manipulation of the limb. Then we identify superficial and middle gluteal muscles as here circled in orange, and they are retracted dorsally without excision of the musculature or the tendinous insertion. Then we identify the deep gluteal muscle just underneath the middle gluteal, as you can see here, circled in blue and with the blue arrows on the cadaver and on the drawing. And in order to get access to the hip joint, we in most cases perform a partial tenotomy of the deep gluteal. And you see here in the dotted line our direction of the tenotomy. This is combined with an incision, or this is followed by an incision into the joint capsule, as you can see here, along here, and combined with an incision of the insertion of the vastus lateralis, so that we have good access to the femoral head and neck. Here we see outlined the insertion into the vastus lateralis once again. We incise the joint capsule, and we need to incise the round ligament to be able to luxate the femoral head from the acetabulum, it's useful to have a Holmann retractor placed dorsally to lift in the area of the femoral neck, to lift it up and to protect our sciatic nerve running underneath. And then, very important is the next step of positioning the leg correctly. We now need to externally rotate the leg so that the patella is pointing upwards, pointing towards the ceiling. As you can see here on the left side, the orange arrow is pointing towards the patella, and this enables us to see the femoral neck and detect and identify the landmarks for our osteotomy. The landmarks for the femoral head and neck are the medial aspect of the base of the greater trochanter, pointed to with the orange arrows, and the lesser trochanter, which is located on the medial cortex of the femur, and the blue arrows point to the lesser trochanter. And these two points we want to connect, and this is our line for the osteotomy. Not in larger animals, we can palpate the lesser trochanter, but in smaller animals, smaller dogs or cats, we can usually not palpate it with a finger. But if we take an instrument, for example, thumb forceps, then we can palpate for the lesser trochanter and the tight string of iliopsoas tendon and muscle which attaches on the lesser trochanter. The iliopsoas is a strong flexor of the hip joint, and we aim to preserve lesser trochanter and iliopsoas attachment and finish our osteotomy just proximal of it. O'Donnell et al. Looked at different techniques to perform the femoral head and neck excision. And they published that in VCOT 2015. It was a cadaveric study, and they had novice surgeons using an oscillating saw or rongeurs. And the examples we see documented on CT. On the left side of this slide, the left image is the use of rongeurs, but an osteotome. So on the left side, the use of an osteotome and mallet is documented on CT. On the right side, the right image documents the use of an oscillating saw. And they found that the osteotome produced much more periosteal bone fragments. They produced cortical fissures, very irregular margins, and also a tendency to have a residual femoral neck volume compared to the osteotomy using a saw. And we can also appreciate that here well on the CT images. So ideally, we use an oscillating saw. And this is what we see here in this cadaver example. The outline of the osteotomy and the oscillating saw applied, and our Holmann to protect the sciatic nerve is positioned in the area of the femoral neck. Once we have completed the osteotomy, the femoral head is often still attached to joint capsule. So then we grasp it. In this case, these are thumb forces, but in most cases, we need to apply a proper instrument like pointed reduction forceps, bone holding forceps onto the femoral head, and then we can lift it up and carefully but sharply dissect joint capsule and soft tissue remnants surround it. And then we should always check that we have resected enough bone, not only the femur head, but also sufficient neck. We can palpate for that, but also we take post-operative radiographs, orthogonal views, and there we assess adequate excision of the femur head and neck. What is your opinion on this excision in this cat? Yes, I would also be concerned that there is an inadequate excision of the femoral neck. So this is a technical error, and that has a high chance of causing clinical problems. So here it is recommended to do a revision straight away and remove further bone, as we can see here. Ober et al., they published last year a case series of four dogs which came back because they had ongoing clinical problems after having had femur head and neck excisions performed before several years ago, and they used also CT findings to assess what exactly was going on. And here's an example of one of these four dogs. They also had inadequate resection of bone, and there's a lot of femoral neck still present. Another technical error could be to remove too much bone, and we see an example here of too extensive resection of bone, which could also lead to clinical difficulties. And in this case series of these four dogs, Ober et al. Reported last year, they also had one dog where they could identify the greater trochanter here, and then they had here part of the femur, but the whole femoral neck and part of the femur were missing. And they stated in their paper that they could not explain the absence of bone between the greater trochanter and the femur apart from assuming that this must have been a surgical error. So this is something we definitely want to avoid. Another complication has been reported when a femur head and neck excision is performed in very young animals. And this is of severe bone proliferation. Here we see an example of a cat which had a femur head and neck excision at the age of 7 months, and we can see it had several other pelvic injuries, bilateral sacroiliac luxations with cranial displacement and pelvic floor fractures with some narrowing of the pelvic canal. That cat was treated conservatively apart from doing a femur head and neck excision. These radiographs were taken 11 years after the initial surgery. Clinically, this cat had mild but detectable muscle atrophy, was occasionally lame, but the quality of life was not obviously affected. I do know that very well because it was my own cat. So after we removed the femur head and neck, we want to ensure that we have performed an adequate resection. We should palpate the ostectomy side, and if there are sharp edges, that needs to be removed with rongeurs, and after that we can close our surgical site. We usually perform a joint capsule, but no other muscle interposition, and then we suture the deep gluteal muscle and the vastus lateralis back and followed by a routine closure. The vessel, our deep gluteal, that is worth to give a little bit special attention, because we want to ensure that it can heal with minimal or no scar tissue and can remain functional. Therefore, a tendon suture should be applied for these flat tendons. Continuous cruciates are very useful as a very quickly to apply but reliably holding a tendon suture, or a locking loop would be another alternative, for example. Our post-operative period is very, very important for the overall recovery and the return to function. We want to aim for a good analgesia. Usually these cases profit from cool packing. We do not want to over-exercise them too early. There is otherwise a relatively high risk of seroma formation. And that could lead to subsequent fibrosis, which could affect function. However, physiotherapy early on is highly recommended with the following aims: to maximize weight bearing, to gain range of motion and muscle extensibility, to strengthen the affected limb, to stimulate soft tissue healing, to provide pain relief, and to address proprioceptive deficits. And it's critical to the success of the oral procedure that we are clear about this rehabilitation plan with the client already before performing the procedure, because that should be part of the overall package of doing the surgery. So in more in detail, some examples how we can achieve these separate aims. Weight bearing can be facilitated, for example, by cross-leg standing exercises, when we lift the good hind leg and the opposite front limb. We could put booties or plastic bag on the unaffected limb with the idea to support weight shifting. Uphill walking can help. Dancing exercises can be applied when we lift the forelimbs, or very simple but very effective slow leash walking, where they are encouraged to put weight on all four limbs. Range of motion can be stimulated. Particularly hip extension is, of course, something we want to put emphasis on by standing with the front legs on a higher surface, for example, a step or stool, stairs, as we see here in that example, or we hold the animal off the ground in an upright vertical position, allowing the hind paws contact with the ground. We can massage the thigh. Exercises to strengthen the overall limb. There, the underwater treadmill is really very, very useful. Or again, uphill walking, diagonal limb standing once again, or we can do sit-to-stand exercises. This is something simple owners can do. So many things of these the owners will be able to do, but it's useful to have that done under supervision of a professional physiotherapist. For pain relief and soft tissue healing, massage can be very supportively used, or ultrasound, laser, or pulsed electromagnetic field therapy. And additional proprioceptive training can then be started a little bit further down the line with Cavalettis, for example, or using the wobble board. Walking over different surfaces, that's again a homework for the owners at home, or walking over a narrow plank. All these are very effective exercises to be used in the overall aftercare. And here we have an example of a little Yorkie, 2 weeks post-operatively after surgery, after femur head and neck excision, for addressing a right avascular femur head and neck necrosis. So if we look at that little dog, it's lame, visibly lame, but is walking already with every step on the leg. And this is certainly something we need to tell the owners. They need to encourage the animals. So we need to get them to use the operated leg very early on. So, this brings us to the question, what does FHNE or FHO do for animals with hip dysplasia? Is this a surgical option we should consider? Is a little bit data out there as well? For example, by Rawson et al. In JAHA 2005, on simultaneous bilateral femur head and neck ostectomies for the treatment of canine hip dysplasia. They had 15 dogs with severe bilateral hip dysplasia and a follow-up survey 6 to 48 months after surgery to assess the post-operative recovery and activity levels of the operated dogs. 12 dogs they had long-term outcome. They had all normal activity levels and they were pain-free according to their owners. The owner satisfaction regarding the outcome of the surgery was high. And these authors concluded that some simultaneous bilateral femur head and neck ostectomy was a viable surgical option for the treatment of painful bilateral hip disease in dogs. Of course, especially when other surgical options were not indicated or were cost prohibitive. So this is something we need to consider, that owner satisfaction can still be quite good. There's a little bit more data, which is interesting to look at, in this paper. Three owners thought that the dogs continued to improve up to 2 years postoperatively. So this could indicate that it's worth to work with these dogs for a prolonged period of time. Seven dogs had a slightly abnormal gait, so this is probably what we would expect, and four dogs had an increased development of front limb and thoracic musculature and slightly atrophied hind limb musculature, which is something we could probably still count under what to be expected. But what do we do with an animal which has a continued poor function after femur head and neck excision despite analgesia and continued physio and hydrotherapy? So, what do we do in a case of femur head and neck excision failure? We could define it as a severe limitation in function, severe lameness, pain, muscle atrophy, severe limitation of range of motion, ongoing despite appropriate aftercare, and persisting despite continued treatment. For these cases, we do also have some data from the literature. Several authors, for example, Liska et al. In VCOT 2010 or Fitzpatrick et al. In Vet Surgery 2012 reported on performing total hip replacements after failed femur head and neck excision. And here's an example of a Chihuahua which demonstrated on radiographs on the left side, but on CT even more, an inadequate resection, severe sclerosis of the femoral neck and remaining proximal femoral canal, which makes the placement of a prosthesis incredibly difficult. Also, the ostectomy is lower than when we perform a total hip replacement in the first instance. So that is something one needs to make up for during the surgery. And here on the right side is also an example that insufficient acetabular coverage was present and therefore this SOP was additionally applied, this string of pearls plate. last year, in 2015, he et al. Reported also on conversion of a total hip replacement in two dogs after unsuccessful femur had a neck ostectomy, and they used the Kion system compared to the biometrics, and that was also successfully done. However, all report that also conversion of a femur head and neck excision to total hip replacement yielded results that were comparable with those reported after initial total hip replacement. The surgical technique required multiple modifications and was considered substantially more demanding. So that means, yes, it can be done. However, we should always consider total hip replacement as a primary treatment when adequate, if possible. So let's come back to our list of indications with our revised knowledge. Femur head and neck fractures should be attempted to be repaired. So only if repair is not possible. Same is true for feline spontaneous capital physeal fractures. Catastrophic acetabular fractures, yes, in most cases, if fixation is not possible. Total hip replacement should at least be considered, but might not be possible. Non-reducible or failed coxofemoral luxations also indicates that we should consider primary fixation first. And in these cases, we can also consider a total hip replacement as a treatment. Failed total hip replacements, yes, for this femur head and neck excision is an option, certainly. And these dogs, after failed total hip replacements, are sometimes dogs which had already several surgeries. They had several revision surgeries, and they have a tendency to fibrose well and have a relatively functionable pseudoarthrosis. So overall prognosis is not necessarily bad in these cases. How does it look with cases of chronic pain associated with hip DJD? There definitely also the total hip replacement is something to be considered in the first instance, and femur head and neck excision as a salvage procedure. So, then I would like to use our remaining time to talk about much less frequent performed excision arthroplasties, but nonetheless, they are interesting, and it might still be worth to have them on our list of potential surgeries to consider. We will start with looking at the shoulder excision arthroplasties. Indications for a shoulder excision arthroplasty could be severe or chronic shoulder joint instabilities, comminuted articular fractures, pain associated with osteoarthritis, dysplasia, or cases of severe OCD and deformation of the joint. Shoulder excision arthroplasty could be considered as an alternative to arthrodesis. Also here we have a little bit of data on the outcome. This is a paper from last year by Montassel et al. In the Canadian Vet Journal, and they looked at short and long-term outcomes after shoulder excision arthroplasty in 7 small breed dogs. They assessed range of motion, extension, and flexion angles, and they found that the operated limbs were not significantly different compared with the contralateral limb on the short-term follow-up. However, range of motion and extension angles were significantly decreased at long-term examination. The muscle girth was not significantly different than the contralateral limb. All owners were satisfied with the outcome of surgery, and all of them would agree to do the surgery again in case of a similar problem. Most reported a mild lameness with no problems at running, jumping, climbing stairs, or going downstairs. Many owners also subjectively commented on how their dog became playful again after surgery. So there's overall some positive feedback in regards to the outcome. They did also radiographic re-evaluations, and they found that there is quite a bit of bony proliferation. These are two different cases on the left and on the right. And on the right, in this case, there it seems like there potentially even that is going into direction of bony fusion. There is a cerclage wire in these cases because they did acromion ostectomies, which is not necessarily in all cases for the approach for the excision arthroplasty. So they concluded that the excision arthroplasty seems to be an effective treatment for chronic shoulder pathologies in small dogs. However, there were some changes. So similar to our femur head and neck excision, we also need to expect some changes in biomechanics after a shoulder excision arthroplasty. Here's an case example from our own hospital, a six-year-old miniature poodle. And we see here caudocranial radiographs of the shoulder. The dog had came with a history of acute onset lameness 6 months ago and presented now with chronic bilateral shoulder luxations. Surgery was performed with the aim to assess joint articular surfaces to consider if stabilization of the shoulder could be indicated. And what we found intraoperatively was that, and you see that on the photo at the bottom, the humeral head of the left shoulder revealed a large full thickness cartilage lesion on the whole of the humeral head. So this meant this case was a candidate for salvage procedure. On the radiograph on the top, you can see that the planning for the surgery and what we want is to direct the ostectomy lines parallel. And there are two different techniques available to perform a shoulder excision arthroplasty, either to remove part of the glenoid and the humeral head, or it's also been reported just part of the glenoid. And this is a post-operative radiograph of that poodle. Surgery was performed bilaterally, and the overall outcome was very satisfying for the owner. Looking at another area of excision arthroplasty, that brings us to the phalangeal excision arthroplasty, which can be either a metacarpo or metatarsophalangeal or an interphalangeal excision. This has been reported as an alternative for digital amputation. Indications could be fractures, degenerative joint disease, septic arthritis has been reported, and there's a little bit of data in the literature available. Only limited, though. Three working dogs with osteoarthritis were reported in 1999, but that was only a German article. And then two dogs with comminuted fractures were reported in JSAB 2007. And that was as an alternative to digit amputation. And these two cases are here shown. On the left side, a big dog, a Bernese Mountain Dog, with comminuted fractures of third and fourth digit and an oblique fracture of the second. And they report that the excision led to a good clinical outcome. On the right side, we see another dog with an excision of the third digit here because of a comminuted fracture. Also, that dog had a favorable clinical outcome. And several years after the excision, they took repeat radiographs and they found that fusion had occurred. And this is also something the German paper had reported, that relatively frequently fusion can then be seen. A little bit similar to this radiograph of the shoulder we've seen a little bit earlier. This is one of my own cases. There was a boxer with a chronic swelling and pain in the area of the metacarpophalangeal joint 5. Not so many much bony changes were there, but there was certainly soft tissue swelling and ongoing pain. So after the dog did not respond to other treatment, we decided for a wide excision arthroplasty, which led to this very distinct looking postoperative radiograph. This dog did very well. However, it's also to consider that this is not one of the main weight bearing digits, and it's only one. So I think this is something important to consider. I have seen excision arthroplasties performed serial in a dog with collapsing digits, and that did not have a good outcome because the pain was only was not palliated, and the remaining instability of the overall paw stayed a clinical problem. So, in summary, we have spoken about the indications, the biomechanical effects, the reported outcomes, including complications, the surgical technique, and the rehabilitation of the excision arthroplasty of the coxofemoral joint in much detail. We also looked at less frequently performed excision arthroplasties of the shoulder joint and the phalangeal joints. One could also talk about excision arthroplasty of the temporomandibular joint and also of the radial head that has been reported. Also, these areas are much, much less frequently performed as well. But it's still good to know that they are possible and can be considered. Overall, it is important to remember that case selection is very critical and optimal surgical technique needs to be performed, and our aftercare, including aggressive physiotherapy, is another important point to consider. And this brings me to a question here I've received in the meantime. And the question is, how early can physio be started? Physio can be started pretty much the day after surgery. Initially, that will be very gentle and more active exercise we want to wait with more active exercise until the skin sutures have removed, so after 2 weeks. But simple physiotherapy exercises can be started and ideally should be started pretty much straight after surgery. And this brings me to our end of our webinar. I thank you for your attention. These are my contact details, and I wish you all the very best for your next excision arthroplasty.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Heidi for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.